If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver 3 essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Their idea of pest control was very rudimentary. So one book was recommending to cure aphids on your peach tree, you should inject the stems with mercury.
That was Vicky Cook discussing Georgian pest control.
There's really no history of that period, so it gave me a free rein. So when people say, oh, it wasn't like that, I say, were you a Hyksos? Were you there?
And that was Wilbur Smith talking about his latest historical novel. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your App Store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History magazine. This year saw Hampton Court Palace open its restored Georgian kitchen garden to the public, recreating the pathways and planting patterns laid down by the palace's Georgian gardeners. We sent our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, to meet kitchen garden keeper Vicky Cook and find out more about the garden restoration project, as well as sample some of the season's produce.
So Vicky, we're in the sort of recreated Georgian garden at Hampton Court Palace. You're the kitchen garden keeper. Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting title.
Yes.
What does that actually mean? What do you actually do here?
Well, I'm responsible for maintaining a display of fruit and vegetables that were in keeping with the Georgian era, which is sort of when this garden was designed to recreate. And to get
some nice produce and have a nice display and show people all about historical fruit and vegetables.
And how long has this recreated garden been here now?
Oh, it's a very new project. We started work on it, well, the gardeners started work on it in February.
Okay, all right.
So this is its first sort of growing season in action, so...
I think it's flourishing quite well.
Yeah, we've had a great weather this year.
Sunshine. I mean, it's raining today, unfortunately, but it's probably quite good for them, I imagine. Just tell me a little bit about the history of this particular site that the garden's on.
Well, the site was originally Henry VIII's jousting arena, so okay. Where they would have had the grand tournaments and the big jousts. But when that sort of fell out of favour, it was disused for a while until William and Mary came along and decided to make Hampton Court their principal residence. And as they were going to be spending all their time here with all their courtiers, they needed to feed them all. And so they decided they wanted a kitchen garden. And so the original jousting arena was divided into six compartments to make more wall space for mm-hmm. exotic fruit and fruit crops. So we've just recreated one of those six compartments.
And so what sort of things are you growing here this year?
We've got quite a range of crops here. Just looking around me, I can see squashes, I can see chicories and endives, parsley, nasturtiums, salsify. We've got lots of beans of various sort, both runner beans and French beans.
And they're all sort of authentic. These would have been grown in sort of the Georgian era, would they?
Yeah, these are all crops that would have been grown in the Georgian times. Now, it's sort of harder to find varieties that date back, but we've got a few varieties that date back to that period. But they're all crop types that would have been known and grown back in the day.
Okay, and I mean, how do you know what was grown here originally? What sources have you been using to kind of to replant this garden?
Well, sadly, none of the sources for this actual garden survive. So although we had an overhead drawing to work on the sort of the layout and the design of it, no records of what was planted here has ever survived. But we're going back to contemporary books. There was a lot written in that sort of early part of the 1700s, gardening guides, manuals, what gentlemen should have in their gardens. One book that's been really useful, it's written in 1706. And it was by, it was a translation of various French works, and it was translated by London and Wise, who were the head gardeners here at Hampton Court. Although they translated most of this from French, they realised that the fruit and vegetable section wouldn't be suitable for an English garden. So they included their own chapter all about fruit and vegetables that would be suitable for the gentleman to have in his garden.
Okay. So, and what in particular does it mention? What sort of vegetables and fruits?
Well, a lot that you'd recognise, but a lot that had us scratching our heads. It's got rock and bowls and hart's horns and scurvy grass and skirrets and things like that.
So. And are you growing some of those now?
Yes. We've managed to trace the seed and we've got them growing away in the garden here.
Okay, and what sort of things are you making, some sort of authentic dishes out of these? How are they being used when you're sort of harvesting these vegetables?
Some of it's going to a market store, so we're selling it, some of it direct.
Okay.
But we are supplying the kitchens here with some produce. So we have big Tudor kitchens here on site, and so we supply some herbs and some vegetables for their displays. But also they do cookery demonstrations.
Okay.
So they've been quite interested in getting some of the more unusual things that you can't just go and buy from Waitrose.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what you'd use scurvy grass.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds really appetising.
No, but probably good for you.
probably
got lots of vitamin C in it.
Was this type of garden kind of usual for the time? I mean, obviously it sounds quite big, and you say that William and Mary they wanted this here. But is there evidence of this sort of thing in other royal palaces and things like that?
Yes, I mean, every royal palace would have had a garden, a kitchen garden, more or less. I mean, you had lots of people to feed, and as the sort of boom in fresh produce and fresh vegetables came in the 17th century, people needed to supply it. So it paid to have your own supply, I think.
So would it be mainly wealthy people who would have been eating this type of thing, sort of fruit and vegetables? You know, if you were a poor person, would you have been able to grow this type of thing in your own garden?
If people had their own little patch of land, then they would have been growing things. Probably they would have had a different diet. You know, the rich would have eaten sort of different things to the poor. One of the things about this garden is that it would have been intensively managed, had lots of gardeners, and they would have done a lot of things like forcing and delaying crops to get an earlier or an outer season crop. So the peasants would have eaten locally and in season, whereas if you could afford it, you ate out of season.
So. Okay. And I mean, how have you decided how it's laid out as well?
The basic layout was all from this plan of 1736.
Okay.
That's I think he was a cartographer, and he did lots of overhead drawings and paintings of palaces and grand houses. It's got the whole of Hampton Court on it, and you can see just in the background, there's the kitchen garden. Mm-hmm. And it had this layout, which has got a cross-shaped central path through the middle, and then you've got quarters, and each quarter is then subdivided by paths going one way and paths going another way. So we've got 260 rectangular beds here for the vegetables. And then around the edge, we've got fruit bands. And so they're very little now, and you have to use your imagination. But these apple trees will eventually be framed as a sort of globe standard dwarf apples. And we've got them interspersed with soft fruit and this very formal box edging around the edge.
For that
sort of formal garden feel. So even though it's a kitchen garden, it would have been used by sort of members of the household or sort of the royal family or whatever for walking round. So it's not hidden away at the bottom of the garden as they would have done in the later era. Mm. You know, the Victorians sort of wanted to keep all the mess and the noise and the gardeners out of sight, whereas we are right next to the palace here. It butts onto the kitchens. So it would have been straight from the garden and into the kitchen. And so it had to look attractive because it would have been used by the family of the house.
So, and how long do you think it will be before, you say it's been going since February, I mean, it looks remarkably sort of well established, you know, just for a few months. How long do you think it will be before it starts to look like it might have looked in sort of the Georgian era?
Yeah, I think if we give it sort of maybe three, four, 5 years, that'll give enough time for these trees to get more height and more shape to them.
Yeah, because box hedges take quite a long time to grow, don't they?
The box is very slow growing, yes. Yeah, so that'll be a couple of years before the little plants meet in the middle and make a proper hedge.
Yeah.
And the apples need to sort of make their full shape. And that will screen off, actually, a lot more of what's going off in the vegetable section in the middle.
So what have you harvested this year? What have you sort of seen? What's done really well?
Well, I've been pleasantly surprised this year. We've had some great weather, so we've been harvesting melons from our specially constructed raised melon beds.
Okay.
I've had quite a reasonable crop of aubergines, which I've been quite excited about. And the outdoor tomatoes have done very well. But also it's been interesting to grow some things that I've never grown before, like the chicories, the endives. And they've been fantastic. They've been a very long season.
And some of the more unusual seeds, I mean, where would you sort of get these from? Where have you found them?
So what I used to do before coming here, I used to work for a charity which preserved heritage UK vegetable varieties. So so I did have a bit of insider knowledge about where to get these seeds. And I did leave my previous job with a few packets.
A stash,
shall we say. And what we'll try and do is save seeds from them in the garden. So that's another skill that they would have used widely back in the day. If you wanted to keep a variety going, you'd have had to known how to get seeds from it to resow the next year. So that's been one source. But you can, if you do your research, find some other suppliers. And a lot of what we're doing is a wildflower seeds. So they would have been bringing wildflowers into the kitchen garden. And so things like the hartshorn and the scurvy grass, you can find them growing wild by the coastline, but we've just brought them into the garden.
Okay. So where next for the garden? What are your plans for it over the next couple of years? Are you going to sort of be rotating some of the things that you're growing or adding any new varieties?
Yes, well, the research will be ongoing. Yeah. We'll have hopefully plenty of wet days over the winter to go and sit down with some of the old history books. We spent a great day at the RHS Linley Library, which is in central London, and that has a room, a specially sealed room with a special environment, which has all of the sort of 15th, 16th, 17th century gardening books in there. So it would be great to spend another day down there and look for more, you know, different types of crops that they were growing, you know, some of the husbandry techniques, a sort of interesting, if maybe not repeatable.
I mean, I was going to say, have you followed any sort of original, you know, way of gardening from the time, or have you been sort of using modern day methods to farm it?
It's been a bit of a mixture. I have to say, some of the old techniques, one should take with a pinch of salt. Their idea of pest control was very rudimentary. So one book was recommending to cure aphids on your peach tree, you should inject the stems with mercury.
I would not recommend
anyone does at home. And they seem to think that most maladies were caused by foul winds from the east. So the general advice was to light a very smoky bonfire just downwind, and when the wind's blowing from the east, and that would hopefully clear away all the foul humours of the garden. But other things I found have been very interesting.
You know, there was, as I said before, they were so expert at forcing crops to get an early crop, and it'd be interesting to try and recreate that. So we've got some hotbeds, and they would have used a lot of horse manure, very fresh horse manure, and the heat as that broke down would create the extra heat needed to bring crops on very early.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was said that you should be able to get melons as early as May, because they were so expert at doing this, and that was the sign of prestige, really.
So it would have been just trial and error, really, just seeing what worked and what didn't work.
Yeah, I think yes, we will try some of these old techniques.
Yeah, definitely.
I can't promise melons in May. I think that might be optimal.
That's your aim for next year. I'll come back next May and see whether they're done. And how would this sort of garden have been run? I mean, would there have been a head gardener? Somebody sort of overseeing the whole thing?
Yes, there would have been a head gardener, and they would have been held in high esteem, the kitchen gardener, because again, it's quite essential to your sort of livelihood if you've got to, you know, to get fresh produce out of the garden. So yes, they were sort of only a couple of rungs below the butler in sort of seniority of these old households.
All right.
So it would have had a head gardener. It would have had this particular garden had 20 full-time gardeners looking after it, but as well as that, it would have had a host of weeder women who were paid a pittance to come in and do all the sort of the manual weeding work.
Yeah.
And it would have probably had a lot of boys to come and squash caterpillars and go out with their butterfly nets and catch the butterflies and scare off pigeons and, you know, just do all the sort of really menial work.
Okay.
So it would have been a very busy place.
Yeah.
The day.
Yes. I mean, was food very important to the Georgians? Would you say sort of more than any other period? Or, you know, this type of garden, was it... I mean, it sounds like it's on quite a huge scale. If this is only 1/6 of what it would have been. Is that, you know, can you see that in any other era, like the, you know, Tudors or...?
I think that from my knowledge, which I confess isn't complete on this one, they didn't really eat so much in the way of vegetables in the Tudor time. It was mostly sort of a meat and bread based diet.
Yeah.
But towards the end of the 1600s, people started recognising that this maybe wasn't the best way, that vegetables actually were probably quite good for you.
Yeah.
Another early source who's been really interesting are the diaries and the books of John Evelyn.
He was
a writer and a philosopher and essayist at the end of the 1600s, and he was a very early vegetarian, and he partly thought that the meat-based diet was what had killed his wife early, and so he was a proponent of eating vegetables, getting your greens down you.
Yeah.
And we see a big sort of upsurge in the use of green veg at this time.
So it's quite fashionable.
Yeah, it became a fashionable thing. Another reason, I think, was that so new technology came over from Holland, and it was the technology of using green manure crops and soil fertility building crops. So before that, if you don't add fertility to soil, you can exhaust it very quickly. But in the mid-1600s, about the time of Cromwell, I think, the Dutch settlers came over, they brought this green manure technique, and all of a sudden you're adding fertility back in the soil, and you can grow much better crops, much better yields, you know, and a wider variety. So
how were they doing that? What was the kind of the technique?
The technique, well, it's just what you can see over there. You see those fine clover beds?
Yes.
That's been grown as a crop, and we'll take the tops off and just compost those, but it's the roots that are doing the work. They are taking nitrogen from the air, and then adding it to the soil sort of through their roots. And so when we turn it in over the winter, it'll rot down, and the next year we'll have a very nitrogen-rich soil for the next crop. It's one of the things that sort of brought on the first sort of big agricultural revolution. All of a sudden we were getting a lot more productive crop-wise in that time.
And we're sort of coming to the end of the sort of summer season now. Have you already started harvesting? I suppose you probably have quite a lot.
Oh yes, we've been picking, harvesting, and selling for the last couple of months now. It's been highly productive, but we're just starting to put some of the winter crops in. So we'll try and keep the garden looking interesting.
Yeah.
So we're sowing lots of things like the corn salads, winter cresses, winter lettuces, things like the endives will sit over the winter time. So so it should look sort of interesting, full of stuff to look at.
I mean, it's all very open. Do they have, you know, we're sort of used to having things in greenhouses and, you know, just to kind of keep things warm over the winter and things like that. Do they have any sort of way of keeping things going through the winter that perhaps you might be using or?
Well, they would have used, so the era that this garden is covering is sort of the late
part of the 1600s to the sort of mid part of the 1700s. And that's when glass was starting to be used in the garden. So the early period, they didn't really have the technology to make panes. They were just using small leaded lights. So the only real way of keeping things going was using sort of these manure hotbeds, which really just extend your season a bit at either end. But then towards the sort of the early 1700s, you start seeing more and more cold frames come in. So not quite your big Victorian glasshouse yet.
No.
But they had things called frame yards, which would have been an area similar scale to this, about an acre, which would have had lots and lots of low glass-covered raised frames on, which they'd have grown things like the cucumbers and the melons in there.
And they had that here, did they?
Yes, it's they've got one at Hampton Court, but now it's where our plant nursery is, so it's covered in large glass houses.
Yes. Brilliant.
We've got a few herbs in this bed that you probably won't recognise, or you certainly don't see in a herb garden so much anymore. This plant here is called tansy. Pick a leaf, so have a rub and a sniff, because it's got a very strong acrid flavour. And to our nose, it's quite unpleasant. Oh, well, this would have been used to flavour egg dishes. They would have made sort of tansy omelettes. It was a really popular thing. I guess strong flavours were popular because it maybe disguised some of the nastier flavours that could have been in food. But yes, so tansy was certainly a popular plant all through the sort of 1600s and into the early part of the 1700s.
You say it's quite, you don't really find it around today too much?
Not as an edible plant, no.
No.
You see it as a weed, really. I think most people would see it as a bit of a weed.
Yeah, it's got that sort of the round yellow.
Yeah, it's related. It's in the daisy family, so it's sort of got those little daisy flowers, but without the white petals on the edge. So
yeah, just the inner bit. And what else have we got in this herb?
These two are savouries. We've got some winter savoury and some summer savoury. You see the summer savoury is starting to go over and the winter savoury is starting to, you know, come into season. But pick a couple of leaves. It has a, well, as I say, it's...
Ooh, that's more of a...
It's a very savoury
flavour. Lemony type of
It's somewhere
smell.
Between a thyme and a mint, and this would have been used to flavour bean dishes.
Okay.
In fact, I think the German name translates literally as bean herb, so it goes very well with...
That's rather nice, actually.
Yeah, really lovely, and really easy to grow, and maybe we should see it in more gardens.
Well, yeah, I mean, is it something it's quite easy to, you can get hold of today, is it?
Oh, yes. I mean, we bought these plants in, it was... You still see it around. The summer one you tend to see as seed, so you grow that from seed.
Yeah.
But the winter one, as it's an evergreen, it's a small evergreen perennial, so it'll stay green over the winter and give you a nice fresh supply.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something I'd quite like to know more about. It's something we grew because it was on the it was in this book of 1706, The Retired Gardener, all about plants that were recommended by the head gardeners here. And it's called Sweet Maudlin, which I think is a beautiful sounding name. And I think it's called that because it smells sweet, but the taste is bitter, so you've got sort of that sweet sadness. And answers on a postcard, please, for what you do with it.
Yeah, you don't know what it was used for.
No, that's it. A lot of the time, we've got these gardening books which reference these things to grow, but not necessarily things to do with them.
It smells a little bit like rosemary, doesn't it?
Yeah,
a little bit.
It's somewhere in between the rosemary and that tansy that we smelled before.
It's sort of got sort of daisy type flowers, isn't
it? Yes, again, it's in that daisy family. Yes. Its other name is English mace, but I think it smells nothing like mace. Right, let's have a look.
There's so much here. We've sort of choice, aren't we, a bit? We see some of the more familiar things here.
Yes, so again, we've got thyme, we've got parsley, we've got coriander, hyssop something, which isn't so much used anymore, but has a lovely smell. Quite an odd sort of hard to describe, really, isn't
it? Not so keen on that. I'm not trying to put that in.
I think some of the historical cooks were making a chicken dish using a lot of hyssop to sort of flavour the broth.
Okay. I suppose they were just trying, seeing what went with different, you know, flavours of food and just...
Yeah, it was what was available, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, the spices would have been pretty expensive back in the day, so it was only the real rich, I'm sure, who could afford things like the sort of cinnamon.
Yeah.
So our homegrown herbs would have been a lot more widely used, I think. So this is another one which to our nose might be a little bit odd, but this is called costmary, and this would have been in every single kitchen garden up until up the 16th, 17th century. And it has a very sort of
Sounds like a flowery...
It's perfumey.
It's a perfumey. Different sort of flowery smell.
Mm. And so this would have been used as a flavouring for beer. So your beer that's why it was in every single garden. It was probably before hops became widely used as a flavouring. People would have used this herb. So I'm intrigued.
I've never smelled that before.
Yeah. Yes, it's very hard to describe.
Yeah.
Not this radio.
No, not really. Oh, yeah, I feel like I'm sort of wine tasting or something, but that's rather nice, though.
Yeah. Yes, it does have a very sort of pleasant aroma. And so the other name of this, apparently, was Bible leaf, because it was it keeps its scent even when dried. It was used a lot in potpourri, but if you were to put a leaf in your Bible, it would keep the bookworms away.
Oh, well, that's an interesting... Maybe I'll take this leaf home with me and put it in a book.
Something else we've got here, which we don't tend to eat much now, is salad burnet. And this is a wildflower that grows in the hills... particularly in hillsides, but if you eat it, it has a slight cucumbery flavour.
Mmm, yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Very unexpected in a leaf.
Oh, it's quite nice.
Mmm, so yes, this would have been a popular salad ingredient. Yes, and here are some of those things that I was mentioning earlier. So this here is the hartshorn, and something else I mentioned earlier was scurvy grass. Now,
yes,
I'm hesitant to get you to try this because it was really tasty in about... June time, end of May, June, but it's got hotter and hotter as the season's progressed, so
try to be brave.
It's like a horseradish type hot.
Oh, right,
so just have a nibble at the edge of the leaf.
Ooh.
Exactly. Again, it's something that you don't really expect from a very sort of innocuous mild.
It's a back of your throat, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, just the way horseradish does. But I think you know, catch that at the right time of year and it was delicious. Or maybe we'll try blanching it or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this is a bit of an experiment. These crops, you know, haven't really been grown as eating crops, or they're not commonly grown as eating crops, so we're still sort of finding out what the best things to be doing with them.
It's not how I imagined it would look, actually. I thought it would be sort of more grassy.
I know. It's a bit of
like a lily, doesn't it? Like a lily leaf, lily pad type.
Lily pad, yes. Mm. They're sort of like kidney shaped leaves.
Yes. I think and whereabouts are the melons you were talking about?
Oh, right, okay, yes.
They'd be quite,
let's strike out for the melonry.
Yes, there. I must see these early early melons.
So this is a special fenced off area for growing melons, and they would have fenced it off partly to keep wild animals out, partly for, you know, I think it would have created a bit of extra heat, but also it was said that to keep menstruating women out, because it was said that they would ruin a crop of melons and cucumbers.
And they would have been in raised beds like this?
Yes, they made raised beds so that they could add manure underneath. So underneath the soil layer here, we've got about maybe 20 centimetres of soil, and under that is some very fresh manure. So literally all the really strawy manure that's just been scraped out of the stable that day, tipped into the bottom, about a foot and a half deep. And as that breaks down, that releases heat, and it's that extra heat.
It does feel quite warm. I don't know whether that's just my imagination, but it sort of feels...
I think partly because we're in an enclosed area and we've got sort of gravel paths and we've got these wooden raised beds, you know, it just, the whole area definitely feels warmer.
Mm.
And we've certainly had an excellent crop of melons this
year. It does look like it, How big do they have to get before you...
Well, these are more or less, I think, ripe. Let's go and see if we can find one that will be definitely ripe. I think these ones have been pretty good. So let's see, I just happen to have a knife in my pocket.
Like all good gardeners.
They are quite small. The ones that will reliably ripen outside in this country tend to be pretty small.
Mm.
There is even a type of melon called a Queen Anne pocket melon.
They
would have, and that was very small, and they would have sort of used that partly for its perfume.
From the
lovely smell of a ripe melon. But yes, it was a sign of prestige, really. You know, if you could afford to grow melons, it meant that you could afford to have a few gardeners and enough hotbed space to.
Thank you.
Try.
That's very. Hmm. That's lovely. I don't think I've ever had a melon that's just literally just being picked.
Yeah. Well, it is exactly. So there you go. You've got the sort of the luxury element of.
Mm.
Of melon eating. You know, we take so many fruit and veg for granted nowadays.
Yeah.
We can just buy them in wherever we want in the world. But, you know, to someone who'd never come across a melon before, this would be a real sort of luxury fruit.
That was Vicky Cook, kitchen garden keeper at Hampton Court Palace. You can find out more about the Georgian Kitchen Garden at hrp.org.uk historyhub.com/Hampton Court Palace. And you can also see a slideshow of images from the garden at historyextra.com/Georgian-garden.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Since June this year, we've been running a series in the magazine entitled Our First World War, which recreates the events of 100 years ago through the voices of those who were there. As regular listeners will know, we've also been including some audio clips from interviews by the Imperial War Museum within the podcast. This time, we move on to November 1914. Here is Royal Fusilier William Holbrook describing the death of a popular colonel around the time of the First Battle of Ypres.
How did the colonel
killed?
How did that happen? Did
it's you... No, I was about 20 yards, 30 yards along the line. And Fiddlane's Cheney, Corporal Cheney, I've never seen him since. I think he must have got killed afterwards. He came along, he said, the colonel had been killed. Been killed? I said, him. I said, no. I said, just along here? So he said, yes. God, he fucked the life out of me. I thought, oh dear, what's I doing there? Because I looked upon him as a father of mine, you know. And he got me his pocket, he gave me his pocketbook, he taken it out of him. So I knew he was dead, so I didn't see him. And he gave me his revolver. And then that was driven back further. So he got his body in, though, in the end. He's got all of his body. And
did it upset you greatly? I mean, you know, because this was a real friend of yours, aren't we? No. Did it upset you a lot when the colonel...
Oh, yes. I didn't know what to do with myself for days. And neither the men were left either. They thought upon him. They couldn't... when he got killed, as though somebody obliterated the whole battalion. Absolutely dumbstruck. They couldn't understand it. They thought so much of him. And what pleased me sometime after was I was in the Tower Army for lunch and I heard two officers talking. And I heard them say... The finest battalion, they said, of our regiment, he said, was the 4th Battalion. He said, the colonel, and the kindest colonel we'll ever have, but we'll have is Colonel McMahon. And I thought, well, it pleased me to hear that. So now, I didn't say anything, I just walked on, but these two officers were talking. They did the officers well, I thought the world of him.
And now let's hear from George Wainford, who was serving aboard the British ship HMS Albemarle, and who recalled his experiences of filling the vessel with coal.
Coal in ship was, I think, the bugbear of the whole business. 90% of the lads aboard would definitely have preferred going into waxing than this incessant coaling. It was a filthy, dirty job, and perhaps you'd been to sea 3 or 4 days, maybe the best part of a week, and you arrive late in the day and everybody was more or less tired out or being on watch and watch for all that time. But if there was a emergency on, you may have to coal all night, and it was really, really tiring work. Now, with the Albemarle, you could, at what they call, they double bank the collier. In other words, you had a collier each side of you, one port, one starboard, and you're working flat out. The collier used to come with a coal in the coal right up to the combings, right up the top of the hatch. Well, the routine was for the seaman to go aboard and stand in the actual coal and shovel it up, and when you got perhaps 10 bags, they were put on a big board, square board, and hoisted inboard. And hour after hour, you kept on filling these bags up until you gradually worked, till you got right down and down and down and reached the deck. It take hours and hours. Occasionally stopped for a drink. They used to make a barley water, big cans of it. We call them fannies, and lower them down, and used to, because your mouth was full of coal dust, it was all over you. And I remember an occasion, we'd been at sea for a long time, and we'd arrived late at night, and when I was only about 17, I suppose, and I was tired out, and the boy's job was to haul these bags up while the able seaman just shoveled the coal in, and, you know, great lumps of coal. And I was really tired, and apparently, and this is true, you mightn't be, apparently I was standing there and I must have gone to sleep standing up. And I remember somebody was sort of being half awake and half asleep, and somebody saying, "Look at that poor little so-and-so, he's half asleep." And somebody shook me, and I was standing up holding his bag, you know, I just couldn't keep awake.
That was George Wainford. You'll find more from our First World War in each issue of BBC History magazine. And speaking of the magazine, our November issue is currently on sale. In this month's edition, you'll find articles on the Peasants' Revolt, Napoleon, the Battle of the Bulge, and the history of Germany. You can get hold of the magazine in all good newsagents and digitally. And now is also a great time to take out a subscription to the magazine. If you're in the UK, you'll get to choose a fantastic free history book when you subscribe, including new accounts of the Wars of the Roses, Thomas Cromwell, and Waterloo. To take advantage of this deal, please visit historyextra.com/subscribe, and it will be available for a limited time only. Our last interview this week is with Wilbur Smith, one of the world's best-selling historical novelists. Born in what is now Zambia, Wilbur has been writing historical fiction for half a century and sold 120 million books in the process. I met up with Wilbur in London recently following the publication of his latest novel, Desert God, an adventure set in ancient Egypt. And I began by asking him why he found this era to be such a rich source of inspiration.
My first opportunity to travel out of southern Africa to the UK with the publication of my first novel, I stopped over in Egypt, particularly to see the sites there and to see the temples, Karnak and the two Valley of the Kings. And the excitement stayed with me for the rest of my life. I went there just to see the Tutankhamun's tomb. I never thought that I would write a novel about it. But in the process of time, I went repeatedly back to Egypt. And in fact, I also got very interested in Lawrence of Arabia. So I hired a caravan of four camels and four drivers, and we set off from Karnak. We went down the Red Sea, just through the desert. And I was nearly a month in the desert with these people and just taking on board the excitement and the tranquility and the mystery of the Sahara and of the Nile. And when the time came and I was ready, I wrote a book about it.
So would you say one of your main sources for writing these books is actually your own experiences and travels?
It is, because I set River God back in the time when the Hyksos invasion of Egypt threw it all into disarray, and there's really no history of that period. So it gave me a free rein. So when people say, oh, it wasn't like that, I say, were you a Hyksos? Were you there? Because it was, it was a mysterious time and just suited very well what I wanted to do with the story.
How important do you think it is that a historical novel is historically accurate, or is it more important to tell a really good story?
Both are important. It's important to get it right as we know it to be. It's much easier if you're writing about the Tudors or something like that. It's very well documented. But it's also fun to imagine a period of mystery in a place like Egypt, which is the beginning of history as we know it. They were the first people to invent writing. There was no written word before that. And such skills as archaeology and medicine, and they started everything going. Because of them, we are what we are.
And you talked before about how you visit places and that helps you get the background to your books. Do you also read historical books as well to get a better understanding of the period?
I try to read histories written by people who are working out, people like Tom Holland, and no Persian fire and those sort of things. I read those, but not so much imaginative histories, which are a lot of guesswork involved.
And one thing that in your books is very vivid is the battle scenes and the fighting. Again, I mean, modern warfare is nothing like the kind of warfare you're describing. So how do you get yourself into the mindset and think about how those battles might have happened?
Well, for me, it's fairly easy because we know what weapons they had. We even have examples of them from the tomb of Tutankhamun, for instance, the chariots and the spears and the arrows and the bows and arrows. And then if you study that and know what they were capable of, and they were fairly effective. I mean, the arrows that... The archery that was developed in those times, and then you have the records. They're fairly flimsy, but you know, the records of how they fought with the tribes around them and dominated them and expanded and became one of the prevalent peoples of ancient times.
And you mentioned before that this period, right about this period of Egypt, has its advantages because we don't know as much about it, perhaps. But is there another reason that you have drawn to this era? So many people write about, you know, Tutankhamun, Nefertiti. But you've gone for a slightly less well-known era.
Well, for two reasons for that. But the main reason is because I am able to let my imagination have full rein. And I'm not restricted by the histories. For instance, if we're writing about the civil wars of the UK, it's all written down. So you don't have the latitude and to let your imagination roam. And I have a very lively imagination, put it that way.
So you've been writing historical novels for quite a few decades now, and clearly one of the world's most successful historical novelists. Why do you think your books are so popular? Why do they resonate with readers so much?
I think my characters act like normal human beings, and they're believable, and people can identify with them. That's the main thing.
And I mean, nowadays lots of people are writing historical fiction. What tips would you give them from your experience to be more successful in their own craft?
Find something new to write about. Because, yes, that's what I did with Desert God series and the River God series, was I found a niche in history which had not been well documented, and it gave me more latitude.
Are there any other historical novelists writing at the moment that you really admire their work?
I enjoy many of them, and some of them are new writers just breaking in. Let me think, there's Giles Christian, and then there's established writers like Tom Holland. But it's such a wide field. There's so many people writing it. It's like anything. Pick your subject carefully, learn about it, and then expand it.
That was Wilbur Smith. Desert God is out now in the UK, published by HarperCollins, and will be published in the US by William Morrow in the next few days. And that's almost all for this week. Do join us again next time, when we'll be talking to Neil McGregor about the history of Germany, and Giles Milton will be sharing some fascinating historical insights from his latest book. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.